You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host for the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview with a very special friend of mine, a friend from way back, Mr. Stephen Sullivan. How are you?
What's up, Nikki? I'm doing really well, man. I'm honored and grateful to be on your show finally. So
I'm so giddy to interview you, first of all. And second of all, I was just about to chime in. I don't think I've ever called you Stephen Sullivan. Ever.
I know, man. I there's a lot of people back in the old days are gonna be like, who the heck is this Steven guy? But yeah, you know, we all go through our artist phases where we turn ourselves into a symbol like Prince. And so I took Steve and became Steven, which is
I like it. But yeah. You've always been Sully,
Exactly.
And
it's kind of a thing that's funny too. It's because I just got engaged and my fiance, every time she's around my family now,
I remember. Thank you. Facebook.
You did. You saw it there. So thanks for, signing into Facebook. But no, it's funny because all my family, it's like everyone that knows me from back in the day kind of has a pass, you know? So you get that Steve pass, but, most people today, I'm like, you're just lazy. There's two syllables. You can do it. Believe me. I trust you.
You're like, come on, dude. You can say my full name. You know,
yeah, it's one extra syllable despite everything. So
I have a pop quiz for you because I want to know if you can remember the first class we ever had together that we first met. This is a tough one.
Wow.
I had to think about it. I had to really think about it, and I got it, I think.
You but, do? Okay.
Seventh grade.
It would have been
only hints. Seventh
grade. Okay. What period would it have been? Was it first, second?
I can't tell you that because I don't give it away.
Because I think that would give it away. Was this one of the classes that you had your pants backwards, crisscross style?
Eighth grade, dude. Oh,
it was
man.
Eighth grade. Okay.
He's
okay.
Still my beating heart.
So this is seventh grade. Then my goodness. I mean, I'm drawing a blank. I mean, I know that we had a lot of classes together.
Yeah,
and yeah. I mean, what did we, I don't know. Can you give me another hint?
I think he had the worst breath I think I've ever smelled to this day.
You want me to do an impression? Here.
That's a very good. Oh, Nikki. Yeah, that's a very good.
That would have been Art. Are we allowed to say his name or should we just...
Well, yeah. Mr. Brack. I mean, yes.
Larry. Yeah. Larry, see? Yeah, you just had to say that. Oh, God. Poor man. Bruh. Yeah.
You know what? We've had some fun, crazy adventures. I don't know if you remember, you and I got very high grades in the spelling bee, and we got to go to Disneyland because of that. Do you remember that?
That's true. We definitely did.
I think it was you, me, Jimmy Estafio.
Yeah. No, we've got some really, really cool moments from our past, Nikki. Spelling bees, and we'll surely get into the rest of it later. But
well, and I heard you got a huge break. Your first big break was in a show choir. Is this what I?
Well, kicking and dragging a younger gentleman that used to go by Nikki back then. Because I feel like, no, we started in theater. We did
That's right.
Musical.
I was going to correct that. Okay. Bye Bye Birdie. I think that was the first time I'd ever seen your, like, acting prowess. And I can say that. No. No, because, I mean, you were the lead. You were Conrad Birdie. Is that the name of the character?
That is Conrad Birdie. Thank you very much.
Dude, you were insanely good at, like, what, 19? Like, ninth grade? What was that, 15? Years old,
yeah, I think something like that. Yeah, I don't think we were driving, we were deaf because they drove me up in the back of an Arcadia police car, which was the last time I've been the last time, but there was the only time I was wearing gold lamé in a police car. I can honestly attest to that. So
that had to be a cool feeling. I forgot about that. That was your entrance, dude.
Yeah, we're gonna bring it into the real thing here, because honestly, it's a moment that like I carry with me to this day, even when I and performing. And it's one thing that really, that I feel like has always been the signature moment in doing live theater, doing film, television, whatever it is. There's this moment where like all the rehearsal, all the, you know, crazy voices in your head of what if, and the, you know, preparation, all of that just has no more place in the moment. And you just have to turn it off and rely on what's happening in front of you and just tune out all those other voices and everything. And there was a moment in that police car where they drove me in onto the stage with it. Well, it was into the auditorium, and then I got out. But, you know, it was a police car. It was a real working Arcadia PD car, and it had no handles on the inside. So I got into that car. They shut the doors. And even if I had that voice in my head saying, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, I was literally locked in that car, and it was go time. So it was that moment.
What a way to make your entrance, you know, to the stage, really. I mean, you know? I know you were doing stuff long before that, but, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, Bye Bye Birdie for me also was, I think, kind of like a badass cast and a badass performance. It wasn't your average, like, you know, middle school, junior high, or I guess we could say high school play. It was a badass music. Yeah. And it was like, we were kind of trailblazers. I don't know if you knew this, but she had never done musicals before because she'd always just done a spring play. But because there was such a musical group coming in, we kind of were the first ones to do a musical. And she did a musical every year after that.
Until she retired. Doc, is that Doc?
That was Ardell Fisher.
Fisher, Mrs. Fisher. Hey, Marcus,
man. Messing memories, dude.
I know, man. Well, it's like, shoot. I mean, well, it was like 2 years ago, right? It was like right at the start of the pandemic, right? When we were in junior high, I think. Yeah.
Right.
No, that's right. But Adele Fisher, yeah, that was, and yeah, I mean, she went all out. She really did. She was, and you want to talk about a woman who was teaching, but also had the most amazing, incredible, like operatic voice herself.
Right.
I actually did another musical around that time period when we were in high school. I did Sound of Music, and Adele Fisher was the Mother Superior character, and
she just
closed the show down every night with Climb Every Mountain. It was like, okay, what is it? I'm 16 going on 17, but that woman is climbing that freaking mountain. Okay. So yeah.
Well, this ties into my first question. I mean, we can reminisce all day long, but I'm really excited to actually hear you, because you are a very charismatic actor. You are playing so many cool roles and you've done so much cool stuff. But what was that moment of zen that when you knew you wanted to become an actor?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I think it was in that art class with you. And I said, I got to do anything I can to get out of here. No, I think I really feel like it's one of those things. And I know it may be cliched, but it's honest. And it's like, I just feel like it was always what I wanted to do. And, you know, maybe that stems from just being the oldest child. And, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, people out there that can argue any direction in that. But just, you know, recognizing when the baby brother showed up that like, oh, hey, this guy's getting more attention than I am. So suddenly find a way to sing a dance to get mom to pay attention to me and put that little baby away. He's fine. So I definitely always had this knack or, you know, personality that wanted to entertain and laugh and have fun. I think I had like this cool, like, box of magic tricks that I would take with me to like form, and I just always enjoyed it. And then I think, yeah, it was kind of transformational when I was, cause I think I started taking acting classes at the Pasadena Playhouse School for Young Actors when I was, third grade, fourth grade or something like that. We would do classes upstairs in the balcony theater there. And I loved it. It was like thankfully my parents were willing to like, you know, put up with it and take me to these classes. And that was my, like, my weekend was like performing and rehearsing at that age. And I just have always loved it. So it's, you know, I think growing up in the Los Angeles area and having, you know, access to some pretty world-class people that may or may not have ever had their truest moment to like hit that limelight in the biggest way that they probably could have either. We were gifted and we were blessed to have gifted people in our extended circles that were willing to teach and willing to like come in and kind of like show you what this world is about, what this, you know.
It's interesting too, because I think we were very lucky to have so many programs around us to kind of influence us artistically. Whereas, you know, if we had grown up in like Podunk, South Dakota, no offense, South Dakota, but you know, we may not have those kind of, you know, that access to those kind of activities to kind of, you know, cultivate that. So That's amazing. Yeah. Third grade. I never knew that about you. It doesn't surprise me, but
yeah.
Amazing. And, you know, you and I did do a show choir with Mike Nolan and Garen. Shout out to Pena too. But, you know, it was funny because you and I had come from Bye Bye Birdie. I don't think either of us did it sophomore year. And, you know, everybody came from Dana and they were like so well-versed in singing in a chorus that it was not something that was exciting for me. But knowing that you were going to do it, I was like, oh, I'll do it. And I think Lindsay Miller, somehow wrote it in. But you know what? Like some of my best moments in high school were with you, Garen, and Mike.
Absolutely.
And some of those performances and doing like tour and all that stuff. And just kind of like having that camaraderie together. Now, right after high school, you got into one of the most coveted acting programs at UCLA. I think you were one of maybe 15 or 20, something like that, out of thousands that got into the UCLA theater program. Tell me what that experience was like. I know we used to hang out at UCLA and...
well, you know, your school, USC.
That's right. We were rivals, but we still kept it cool.
Well, that was the coolest thing I always thought too, is like, you know, I know there's rivalries, but like within the world of, you know, performance and music and theater, like we just saw we're on this to collaborate. Like, we're not going to like deny you for that, you know? So we definitely still kept in touch, but UCLA was a major transformative experience in me. Just like, not only in terms of just, you know, taking the next step, in my progression and my career that I was on a path for, but it really, I mean, it was an amazing experience just in general as a school, because they really, I came, you know, like you said, the myth or the concept of the small town, which is across America, but then, you know, we were, like we said, lucky to have a bigger version of the small town, but this dropped me into such a multicultural experience that in my freshman year, I mean, I was studying like, you know, Buto theater from, you know, all over the world. And we were basically like every week, whatever amazing international artists were coming to perform in Los Angeles would come and mentor or show us and teach us. So I went from bye-bye, serious, like deep, like cultural understandings. And my mind was just blown open at that point and just really saw just what else was available out there in terms of just the entire world of performance theater art in general. So it was an amazing experience, of which I'm really grateful for. And
I'm sure it also tested you a little bit, because you know, with all of these artistic programs, they want you to know the history, the classics, you know, Shakespeare. They want you to know some of those early plays. Did you kind of draw inspiration from that? Or was it like a good way to kind of get into the technique and history of theater and, you know, just kind of start getting well-versed in it? Or was it something that you kind of were turned away from just because it was so dated?
Yeah, I think had I been told I would be experiencing that as a senior in high school, I probably would have been like, oh, I don't want that. But I think, you know, like I said, my mind was just completely blown off. And so like, there's parts of me now even that wishes, you know, what youth is wasted on the young or something like that. But like to go back and to be able to have the opportunity for these like world-class teachers and these lectures. And like, I definitely just groggily went through a few of those classes that now I wish like I had, man, at this point in my life, I would love to go back and be able to really like lean into more of the knowledge that was being offered to me. But at the same time, I really felt like, I mean, my freshman year was an intense one, because the entire class of freshmen, we had every single class together. They really wanted to create like that culture of just like all of us. Like, so although it was UCLA and it was this massive school, I mean, I was basically in class every day of the week with the same group of actors and writers and directors. And we basically like, you know, it was like a family, which actually helped a lot, because in bigger schools, I know some people tend to lean towards like, you know, the Greek experience and finding fraternities or sororities, but we had our own little like theater kid one, which really was really wonderful to really anchor into the college experience and to like have a group of friends that I was so tight with right off the bat. So,
no, I know
but yeah, I think
you did a lot of plays and stuff. Did you start doing student films and kind of collaborate on that? You know, how was that different from what you'd done before?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think before that, my entire experience was musical theater or live theater stage. I wanted to try to get into some acting, like commercials and TV, at a younger age, but that was where my family kind of were like, "No, we're not going on that ride yet." So when I got to UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, that whole department was available right there, and so I was instantly, you know, meeting, you know, television directors and writers and, you know, cinematographers. And so, yeah, I mean, they pooled from the acting talent that was found with acting school. So I had a couple student films, some black and white, like silent 16 millimeter films. They're out there somewhere, but yeah. And then I did my first on camera film role in college, and that was for this director, Eric Grush. And that was a film called The Cousin of Sleep, which to this day is actually a really beautiful film. It's a short film, and I don't know where it is at this point, but shout out to Eric Grush and that experience, because that was my first like foray into cinematic film acting. And and that is like something that to this day I'm still really proud of, because it was something that I've always wanted to do. And the film itself was so beautiful, artistic, and just creative that it was the wonderful introduction into on-camera performance, as opposed to, like, you know, stabby guy number four in the background or something like that. I was the lead, so it was like really humbling experience. That
in school, did you go through method acting? Like, yeah. What was the thing you kind of gravitated towards to kind of find your creative process?
Yeah, I mean, we learned all the techniques, so to speak. That was the other thing. They didn't really, you know, it wasn't as much a conservatory where they want to just kind of instill one doctrine or one kind of technique on the actors. It was like this freshman year especially, it was like, let's learn all the techniques and see which one you resonate with. And you know, I kind of pick and choose from a lot of the different techniques. To say that I just, you know, went with one direction, I don't know. I've always just kind of liked the experience of walking in another's shoes and just really trying to get to the heart of what that experience is, and, you know, finding my access to empathy and really just, you know, what people have kind of said is like, you know, a chameleon type actor, where you just kind of like absorb it. And I think that stems from like my even, you know, very young experiences of understanding, trying out what performance was. And so, you know, that's why I think when I had the opportunities to like kind of play these well-known figures, it's been something that I've always loved and wanted to do, because it's just, to me, it's like, just, I watch the study, I study the tape, I watch the person, and just, you know, try to like literally physically get into that body and that physical experience. So
that's amazing. You know, I don't think I've ever asked you this in all the years I've known you, but like, how do you kind of peel the layers to get into a character? Like, let's say you get this role, and we're going to showcase some of your work, but like, you know, when you get this role, do you start researching either a character's, you know, traits or like habits, or how do you kind of get into that inner part of the character?
I feel that for me, it starts with the text, it starts with the script. The words they are putting on that page they're thought out. They're not just thrown on the page. And therefore, that's truly what you need to start with. And so all of the directors that I've worked with in my experiences, whether it be film, television, or even, you know, mostly theater, but, you know, the homework, the rehearsal always begins with a deep dive into the text. So once you have that text in your body, that's when you also start to explore physicalities, you start to explore, you know, cadence, rhythm of voice, and all the other mannerisms a character may imbue but it all stems from what are the words say? Why is this character saying this line in this specific moment to achieve what end? And once you can understand the pathology of why a person's using these words in these contexts, then you can start to understand the psychology behind the person. Place or thing, you know.
That was fantastic.
Ever playing a mountain.
Yes, this is a record, because this is the most serious conversation.
I'm like, should I throw in something to throw them off right here, or should
are they gonna heckle each other? So, you know, it's amazing. I mean, all of that, what you just said, is like pretty like intense and amazing. So you get through college, and I know you went through this, because I went through this too. You know, I went to USC Music School, and like, you know, as soon as I finished, I was like, I want to start in a rock band. And it's like, you realize that all your training and everything was great, but you start at the same level that everybody starts at. Yeah, you start at the very bottom, and you have to work your way up. So yeah. you get out of this, you know, coveted theater school that's one of the best in the country. You're with some of the best actors, directors, and then you're out in the real world and you have to get an agent. You have to submit headshots. Tell me, like, what that first year of the grind and the hustle was like for you, because I know it wasn't easy. I think it's one of the only things that's harder than music is doing the acting hustle, especially when you start out from school.
Yeah. No, I mean, I respect anyone that is taking those first steps, you know, because I've been there and I know the excitement, the trepidation, the just enthusiasm, and also the deflation that happens right off the bat. All of those things are palpable and present from day one. And yeah, I mean, I was fortunate. I came out of school and some of the teachers there, a lot of them, you know, It was a tough experience because, you know, the industry is constantly changing, as it is even to this day. But it was a big transition, like right when we graduated from college, because it was right at the start of, you know, 2000s, not to date ourselves. Right. But it was when you graduated like. Yeah, no. But it was the time period where suddenly, you know, technology had caught up to the point where there was this big movement of directors and people taking film as the only medium. But then at the same time, the camcorder was coming out and all of these technologies with these handheld devices that the picture quality was actually really good. Right. So a lot of people just started, like, I had a really core group of friends and we just started making our own movies. We just were like, let's do it. We were entering into these like 48-hour film contests and just like turning around content. And so that was just a kind of a way to cut our teeth and just stay relevant, or at least do what we thought. And so, you know, right outside of college, I basically was making films with my friends, making videos, just trying to figure something out and get it out there. You know, the dreaded web series, which was such a dreaded word back then. But I mean, you know, in some ways, I mean, that was the fledgling streaming world that we have today. I mean, who knew back then that the streaming services would not only, like, these web series become streaming services, but now they're the film studios. They're creating the content, and it's like makers and web series back then. It's like, you know, a lot of people did make it past that, but, you know, my journey. but it started with just, you know, actually I was really lucky. I came out of college and found a manager right away, and she started working with me and hadn't sent me out into auditions. And
did you like call around, or did you get referred? Did you send headshots? Because I know that's the also you have to send out headshots to everybody, right?
I lucked out because there was another classmate of mine that was already with a manager, and so she asked him. She's like, "Oh, you're UCLA. Do you have any other, you know, young talent that you think would be a good fit?" And so he suggested me to her, and, you know, thankfully she took me on. Are we allowed to say a little bit of blue color? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the story behind that is really kind of funny, because his name's Jamie and he was with this woman, this manager. And he told me, man, I don't know. Like, what are the advice? He goes, "Oh, don't worry about it." He goes, you're an Irish kid. She's going to love you. So I got on the phone and I was like, "Hey, hi, nice to meet you. Yeah, my name is Steven. I hear you like working with Irish, young Irish boys, Irish actors. Are you Irish?" And she goes, "Honey, only by injection."
You should have answered the phone and been like, "They're always looking for me, Lucky Charms."
Well, here we go then. No, she was a total character, that old school Hollywood manager type. And she used to say, like, "Honey, I don't wear skirts because my balls will show." So yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
It was, yeah. She was a piece of work out there. But yeah, she actually did right away help me, you know, like, start my career right out the gates. And she helped me get a commercial agent, helped me get a theatrical agent. And I was blessed and fortunate right off the bat. National commercial. Yeah. Yeah. Taquitos. Having a man suck on my fingers for slinging 7-Eleven taquitos, you know, living the dream, living the dream.
Work is work, dude.
Living the dream. Well, yeah, some of it's better than others, but.
See, that catapulted you, like, you know, what's funny, you're a very accomplished actor and artist, and you've had these amazing opportunities that you kind of gloss over because it's like, oh yeah, you know, I did this. But you were in a movie called Gods and Generals, and you had a really poignant, really cool scene. Kind of talk a little bit about that scene, because I don't want to ruin it for people, but you got this movie, and it was with Robert Duvall. It was Jeff Daniels, I think.
Jeff Daniels, Mira Sorvino. Yeah.
So you're in the big movies. You do this major movie. Tell me what that experience was like.
That was like, to this day, again, like, well, you know, you're right. It's like, I do kind of just see them as all my experiences, but now in reflection, they are amazing. And I'm so, so incredibly grateful for all of them. And this was no other exception. I mean, it was For Gods and Generals, which was an epic Civil War drama directed by Ron Maxwell. And I kind of got the part because of my connection with my manager, because she had her other client who was another role on the show. And so, you know, there were so many parts for young soldiers, because that was what it was about. It was about the Civil War. And so I kind of went in and just read generic copy. It wasn't for a specific scene. It was just like, you know, be a young soldier. So I did. And then I found out I got a part. I didn't really know what the part was until like about a week before shooting. And then they said, okay, we're going to send Steven out. So it was the first time I'd ever flew first class. That's Thank awesome. You, SAG-AFTRA. I got out there and, you know, it was an incredible experience. And another actor that was part of the show actually was on the flight with me, was C. Thomas Howell. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I got to sit next. Yeah. I got to sit next to him, and I was just so nervous because I was like such a baby back then. So green, but I got to set, and the scene is actually really pretty special. I mean, I don't think it's like a spoiler alert. We know how the Civil War ended, so. Yeah. Well, 18. Okay. But no, it was an amazing role, because the whole thing, the film was, it's very verbose. It's very right. like gods and generals.
I mean, it's an epic. It's a Civil War epic.
It was the first film to have an intermission in it since like Lawrence of Arabia. So it was epic. But the scene was such a unique one, because in the entirety of the film, it was always conflict and battle and soldiers and people pontificating about, you know, war and everything. And this scene was based on actuality, which is during Christmas along the Rappahannock River in Virginia, I think it is. There was like a Christmas Day truce. And we hear about this in other wars as well. But the soldiers that were fighting literally knew there was like a treaty that day, like there was no war to be had. And they're literally opposite sides of a river. So they put down their weapons and they walked across the river and talked to each other as human beings and recognized their differences and similarities, and probably had that moment of like, why are we doing this? And then, okay, well, you know, back to war the next day. But so that scene was really special, because it was literally like a sequence where when we shot it, you know, they gave us basic dialogue across the river, and then we had to wade into the cold Rappahannock River, and they basically, you know, it was the other funny thing I'll get to, which is it was the very last, it was the martini shot is what they call it in a film, which was the final shot of the entire film. And they've been shooting for 3-4 months. I mean, and so they were kind of just doing it as like, well, we had this concept at this moment. Like when I was wading into the water, I had my uniform on, my costume. And they said, you know, we probably don't have another costume for you, so don't fall, because this is the only take we'll do. So in the scene, I had a cup of coffee, and the other, I was a Union soldier and he was a Confederate, and he had a pipe of tobacco, and we called across and we said, hey, you got coffee? You got a pipe? And I said, yeah, let's go. So we crossed. I've made other friends with a pipe too, but that's another story. But we get across the river, and then, you know, we have this moment of recognition of like, oh my gosh, this is the enemy, but here we are exchanging something, a kindness with one another. And so he handed me the pipe the pipe, and I handed him the coffee, and, you know, they were just kind of like, just have a moment, be with each other, and then go back to your side. They gave us no dialogue for that scene. Wow. And so in the scene though, you know, they gave us an action to play, and then I just was like, trying to like look the guy in the eye, but the actor was not looking me in the eye. I think he was doing his own thing, or maybe he was just like, I'm acting. I'm really acting.
Hello, we're doing this.
Yeah. But so I kept trying to engage with him, like to get him to look at me. And I was nervous because I was afraid of falling and all of these things that were happening at once in real time. And it ended up being this beautiful moment in the film. Then they kept it like uninterrupted, which is crazy, because in a film of all about these dialogue, it was literally a minute and a half, 2 minute sequence of zero dialogue, silence, not even like music overlaying, just like the river sounds. And it really showcased the entirety, the crutch of this entire conflict, which is like, these are just people. You know, I know obviously we're fighting for something beyond these two men, you know, change for the entire world, which is for the better. But when you break it all down, it's just people that have been able to find a resolve to a lot of conflict, you know?
We're in that right now. We've seen that with Russia and Ukraine.
So absolutely.
Poignant story. And shout out to my brother because he was the first one to tell me. He was like, yo, I saw this movie and Steve Sullivan had this cool scene. And I was like, that's amazing. He told me about it. I got to see it. So I saw it, you know?
Can I tell you one other fun story from that, which I haven't really told? Okay. It was so cool because, you know, it was my first experience on set and it was the last day, right? And so my manager told the other actor that was working on the show with me, who was also a client, like, keep him under your wing, make sure he's okay. He's a baby. And so, you know, my scene was the final scene of the day, final scene of the film. And so because it was the final, like, gathering for the cast and crew and lunch, Ted Turner was a producer on the film. So he showed up that day for the lunch in full regalia with treasure chests that opened up, and they had flown in Omaha Steaks Maine lobster for their hard work. And I was there and they pushed my scene till after lunch. So I was like so nervous, I couldn't eat. So I sat down and the friend that I was with, my manager, he invited me to the table and I was sitting next to Robert Duvall, Jeff Daniels, and like the main cast. And I was so nervous that I just couldn't eat. So I had literally a bowl of clam chowder when they're all eating steaks and Maine lobster. And Robert said, he looked over and he said, eat up, son. It's as good as it's going to get. And I said, oh, yeah, well, I was like, my scene's after lunch and I want to come in prepared. And I think he looked over and he kind of like, okay, that was nice. That was nice. So I did my scene and then I went back to my trailer, and in my trailer in a box was a Maine lobster and an Omaha steak. And it was signed by Robert Duvall and it said, keep it up. You're on way.
How have you never told that story before? That is crazy.
I know. Well, I think, I mean, that's my moment for that film. And yeah, it was an incredible moment. And just to show like him recognizing a young actor and just doing something of that magnitude that I've never forgotten. So
well, really amazing. Those kind of gestures, especially like those old schoolers.
Yeah.
It goes a long way and they know it. And it's like, it's that touch of class that you're like, man, you are a total mensch and you're such a badass. That must have meant a lot, man. And that was, 2003, something like that, right?
Yeah, actually, it was 2002 because they had to halt production because there were cast and crew that were on flights that were flying out of September 11th out of New York. And there were cast and crew that actually were going to be on that plane because it was the plane going from LA to I think, DC. And so... or New York too, but I can't remember which one, but they had to halt production for a minute when the tragedy of 9/11 occurred. Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah. But well,
let's fast forward a little bit to one of my favorite shows that you were on that you didn't even tell me that you were on, Vinyl, and you were playing, you know, some guy named John Lennon, which I mean, holy shit.
Who?
Dude, you and I have both been huge Beatles fans. We're huge music fans in general, but, you know, I remember watching this show and I was like, holy shit, Steve Sullivan is playing John Lennon.
That's
I gotta tell you, I've seen a lot of Beatles movies. I've seen a lot of people play John Lennon. Dude, you were the most convincing. And I'm not just saying this because we've known each other. No bullshit. You were the most convincing John Lennon because you knew all of his storied past. You knew everything about his background, his traumas, his attitude. So when they showed that scene, and we're going to show this right now, it was so real. Let's show this in real on vinyl.
Well, how are you doing?
Hey.
No photos. No snaps tonight.
Give the man some space. Come on.
Sorry to be a bother. Do you mind just one?
She's impossible. Forgive us.
I wouldn't ask if you didn't have such a kind face.
One.
Thank you. It's the silver button. I have it all set up. Come on, baby. Come on, I'm
steering up. Shall we try one now with your heads in the picture?
So what, do you work here or something?
Matter of fact, I do. In charge of keeping the ice cubes cold.
Yeah.
some champagne.
Oh, thanks. That's sweet. But my friend and I are only here for the night. They say if you come here, sometimes you can see a celebrity.
Dude, it's such an epic scene, man. You got Bond playing in the background.
I know.
I mean, everything about this scene is so bitchin'. And you know what? I was watching it. I loved that show. I still think it's one of the best. I was so bummed that it didn't get renewed for a second season because it was so well done and it was so smart and sharp and it was just costumes were epic. I mean, dude, you had to have looked yourself in the mirror before you even shot that and been like, holy shit, I'm John Lennon right now. Tell me what that experience was like and tell me what the audition experience was like to get that role.
Man, well, I could give an hour about that, but it happened. But basically, when I first graduated from UCLA, I auditioned for this film that I don't think ever got made, but it was about the band The Turtles. And it was about a moment where The Turtles met Jimi Hendrix in London right at the 1967. And there was a John Lennon character in it, but it was John Lennon from 1967. And I auditioned for it. And the casting director at the time says, this is a role you're born to play, but you're not old enough yet. And I said, why? And then cut to when this finally came out, my manager said, I've got the part for you. And she said, it's John Lennon. So I immediately had the dialogue and had a good friend of mine, Peter Smith, helped me record this scene, and we did it. And and in order to get the role, I had to get the approval of the big three, which was Scorsese, who produced it, Mick Jagger, and Terrence Winter, who wrote Boardwalk Empire in this. So I sent the tape off. I literally never doubted that I didn't get it. I just knew that this was meant to be.
That scene in like what, your living room or something?
Yeah, with the curtain up just like this and like, but it's something I used to watch you used to watch it with me. I feel like we used to listen to it. We used to listen to Rock and Roll Circus with Mike Nolan. And like, there's a sequence in that. And that was where I got the voice down, where he's high as a kite talking to Mick Jagger. And he's like, Winston, he goes, Michael, it's just a pleasure to be here. I want to thank you on behalf of all of us. And I just watched that. And he's like, are you really, John? Dirty. But I used to listen to that, and I just kept listening to that moment to get the dialect down. And then when we got it in, and I found out I got the approval of all three, and I was on my way. And I hired a dialect coach that I worked with in LA, and he said, you know, I don't think I need to teach you anything you don't know. And then when I got there, I did the same thing. They booked me for like 3 hours of dialect work. And after 20 minutes, he's like, I don't even want to get in your head about what you already have. You're there. He said, I'll be on set if you want to talk to me. But he said, I don't want to get in the way of what you already have. And it was this amazing moment, this amazing story, because they flew me out to New York. And I was staying at a friend's Upper East Side, like, it was his family member's place, and it was incredible. And I just wanted to be there and soak in the city as much as possible. And I knew I wanted to go to Strawberry Fields right by the Dakota where the memorial is.
Yep.
So on the day that I had my voiceover work, it was like an 8 a.m. call down at like Times Square. And I just decided I was going to walk all the way back up. So as I was walking up, I came across the museum. I forget which one it is. I'm not bad at my New York geography. Sorry, Manhattanites. But it was like the MoMA up there or something. It was right at the south end of the park. And I was like, well, crap, I got time.
Natural History Museum.
No, it wasn't this one. It was a modern art one. Oh, MoMA. Okay. Yeah. But I went in and I started walking through the museum, and I just was absorbing all the artwork. And then I got in the elevator and I was about to go. And the docent there said, oh, have you been up to the top floor, the fourth floor? And I said, oh, no. What's up there? He goes, oh, you got to go. And I was like, okay, cool, I'll go. And he pushed the button, goes up, elevator doors open, ding. A retrospective of John Lennon and Yoko Ono's artwork and collaborations that I did not know was there. Yeah, so John was guiding me the whole way. And I just disbelief toured that museum. And there's one of the famous Yoko Ono film, which is like this long play, which is like a slow motion of, it's called like a smile or something, but it's John Lennon going from a smile to a frown, but it takes place over the course of 5 minutes and just is so slow. And I was just standing in the center of the museum room there watching that with all these people are walking around me. And this docent comes, he goes,
like I'm in a movie.
Mildly. Yeah. But then, so that just blew my mind. Then I continued my journey up through Central Park, ended up at Strawberry Fields, and just sat in that iconic memorial, right, and just observed all the people coming through and how much this man meant to everyone, and just soaking that energetic current in. And the beautiful thing about that space is, like, I think it's every 30 minutes or so, but there's like all these buskers, these people that come and play classic John Lennon music or Beatles music, and they all swap out like after 30 minutes. It's like they have it down. And so I was just sitting there listening to the different people performing, you know, live in the park right there. And there was a guy that sat down right next to me, and he performed, and he was beautiful. It was just like man and his acoustic guitar. He's an older gentleman, and he just really could play. And like, just, I felt like the essence of John as well. It wasn't just like, I'm doing this to get money. It was like, he was channeling the soul as well. And afterward, I just turned to him and I said, you know, thank you. That was, you know, sitting next to you, I had the same experience. I felt his presence with you next to me, and I felt inspired. And I said, well, you know, I'm actually here to perform as John Lennon in this new TV series. And he said, John's here. I could feel it. He's in support of you. So,
wow, dude.
I didn't.
That's all over, bro.
I didn't need anything other than that. But yeah, once the other funny part about that experience was when they were trying things on, they were trying on different glasses. And the thing they did try on, which are these like epic sideburns that were actually made from human hair. And once they put those on,
real chops, dude.
I still got the high school version that I was trying when I was trying to be Chris Weiland or Stone Temple Pilots or some crap, but Scott Weiland. But when we got into the makeup chair and everything, before we did the scene, we shot it in Brooklyn, and it was this cool old, like, that was the actual location. It's like an old restaurant. The director, he was this amazing man. Oh gosh, I'm blanking his name, but he's Scottish. And we did the rehearsal without all the extras in place. And so we went into the room, and I wasn't in hair and makeup yet. I was just in street clothes. And so we did the blocking rehearsals with camera and everything. And he's like, okay, this looks good. Let's do it. And then he's like, go ahead and get into wardrobe. So I went into my trailer, got into wardrobe, and then I was waiting. And that was where the butterflies started to kick in. And then they're like, okay, it's time. And this was as close as I may get to what you experienced, Nikki, as a rock star, which is that moment of rock and roll, like walking down the hallway and like rock and roll, and there's an energy, as you're getting as you're getting closer to the stage, and it's just like whoa. But then the doors swing open, and they hadn't told the extras who was the scene about, because they really wanted to keep the celebrity cameos quiet. You know, they wanted NDAs, and they didn't want this to be leaked. That was a big part of the show, was like, who's going to appear next week, which actor portraying. Yeah, I mean, the Bowie character was phenomenal as well. But so when I get in there, and all of a sudden it was like that, where like the crowds were parting, and I was walking in, they're like, it's John Lennon, it's John Lennon, it's John Lennon. I'm like, where? Oh, it's me. and then the director, oh, John Baird, that was his name. And I get to him, they're like, okay, John, your actor's ready. And he turns around and he goes, Jesus fucking Christ, Stephen. And I go, sorry. And he goes, he just heart attacked me. I thought John Lennon's in front of me. And so I was like, he's like, you're ready. Just go in front of the lens. So it was awesome. Yeah.
And how many takes did you get? Yeah. Was it just one or two, or did you get a couple?
We did a few. Yeah, we did a few, but you know, we did, you know, you do the angles and, but it was really pretty efficient, really pretty quick. Cause you know, there wasn't a lot, you know, we really, it was a tight machine. And then like, for me too, to see like Mark Waters on stage, and it was just like the cool, like I never got to see Bob Marley. Obviously a lot of us didn't, but like I was having the experience of like being able to see this Bob Marley show, because the actors they hired were all musicians. So they were all playing their instruments and playing, they had a track going over it, but they were all musicians. So they would just jam in between, and they'd have to tell them to be quiet. But just, I was like, man, this is cool. I'd be here for the experience of being an extra, just watching Bob Marley. And yet now I'm also playing John Lennon. So it was like,
well, it was also like your approach was so bitching. I mean, it really, thanks, I know it's not like I'm like 80s. It was totally bitching, man. But really, honestly, it's like, it's one of my favorite things that you've done. And it was such a great depiction of him. And like, you know, I'm a Beatles, not, you can see my wall of Paul right behind me. It's right here, right
here.
I
see it. I love it.
So, you know, I'm obsessed with the Beatles, and I knew that period of John. That's when Yoko and he kind of split. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, you should be with my friend, mm-hmm. the girl you're with.
Yeah.
And he was like trying to just like cover up his pain, but also be close. And like he was going through this alcoholic phase where he didn't want paparazzi. So it's like when you started doing all those things, I'm like, dude, he's nailed this. He's done the research to know exactly what level yeah. of, or I should say, what era of John Lennon you're kind of portraying. Mm-hmm. It was yeah. so, you showed a human side to John Lennon in that. Yeah. It was so great, man. I really
thanks, man. And just to be honest and get real with it, you know, like I've had my struggles as well. And so, you know, not to get too personal about it, but it was something that I could definitely relate to. And, you know, I think that's what it's all about, is relating to other people's experiences and just taking it from your own. Obviously, I can't relate to him on the level of magnitude that he was, but his whole time period, that whole last weekend where I think Nixon had just won and like he was having a hard time and don't come back. So he came to California, he came to LA and like had this epic bender that they dubbed the Lost Weekend, where he was basically just like him and Harry Nilsson and Alice Cooper. They're at the Rainbow Room just getting wasted. And, you know, this man about peace, like getting in bar fights. It's like this time period. Everyone's like, ooh, that happened. But, you know, it really did get him to change his ways, change his life. And ultimately he came back, got back together with Yoko and had Sean. And like he says in his own words that those periods afterward where he kind of got sober, so to speak. And those are the happiest years of his life, tragically, before he was, you know, assassinated. So,
well, you showed this like double-edged sword of like, you know, you showed the rock star side of him, you showed the frustration side of him, and then you showed when when she broke, you know, Olivia Wilde did that, you know, had the picture swap basically, mm-hmm. and you just had this moment of humanity that in that such a like a humble moment, and it was like, oh yeah. man, nailed it! It was such a cool piece. Yeah. You know, you were in so many cool scenes in that. Now, I'm going to showcase a whole bunch of your scenes in your reel in a bit. But okay. you've done a lot of stuff. You've done some scenes with Mad Men. You did a Rizzoli and Isles. You know, like, you did a scene with Angie Harmon. Do you have any favorites or any roles that you kind of really felt connected to outside of John Lennon? We know that was, you know.
Yeah.
Were there any other that you felt connected to in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I have all the roles I've been fortunate enough to have had. Like, I love all the characters. I don't know if you have to, but like, I think when you get this opportunity to invest yourself into a role and a character, it's something you do really want. I mean, I love. I don't say anyone can do whatever they want to do, but for me, I love them all. But yeah, the Mad Men role was also something that really, really meant a lot to me because. My manager that I'm still with, Eileen O'Farrell, I love you. Mwah. She really transformed my career and got things back on track when I first aligned with her. She was the one that got me the Rizzoli and Isles and then Longmire and ultimately Mad Men and Vinyl. And so I'm forever grateful for her and her really helping me align myself and my purpose and get me some amazing opportunities. But when, because I was a fan of Mad Men from season one, you know, and I don't exactly look like your Wall Street buttoned up guy. So I knew that if I were ever to be on the show, it would probably have to be in the later 60s if they ever made it that far in the show. And then there was an opportunity maybe to join the hippie movement. And yeah, sure enough, I'll never forget it. I was actually soul searching weekend and my manager called me on the way and said, honey, whatever you're doing this weekend, be safe because you have the audition for Mad Men that you've always wanted on Tuesday. So I was like, okay, this is happening. And so I felt, if anything, I was saying in character, diving out into the desert in a plant medicine ceremony. So I just channeled all of that. But when I came back, it was, again, one of those things where, I mean, I just always felt it was mine because I'd always talked about it with her about wanting this role. And then when it finally came to be, it was right there. So I loved that experience just because it was such a trip to be coming onto the show as such a fan myself personally. And then to see, you know, John Slattery, Roger Sterling and like, and, you know, they were also very careful with the script, like even totally different from what we ended up shooting, but it was the essence, but like code names, you know, they wouldn't give the character names that were actually in the scene. And so, you know, it was like, okay, well, this scene is basically taking place at a hippie commune, but I don't know who all these other people are in the scene. Turns out it was, you know, Roger and his daughter and all of that. And, you know, it was really showcasing the upstate New York hippie communes that were sprouting out in the late 60s and this counterculture movement of people that had, you know, moved even beyond the, you know, drop acid, tune in, turn on, drop out. It was more so like, let's get off grid. Let's just completely live off the land and follow the cycles of the earth, man.
Right. Well, let's play a little bit of this. We're going to play the reel, and you may see some of the scenes from vinyl at the beginning, but we're going to play Steve's reel and show you some of these scenes. Here it comes.
Give the man some space. Come on.
She's impossible. Forgive us.
I wouldn't ask if you didn't have such a kind face.
One.
Thank you. It's the silver button. I have it all set up. Come on, baby. Come on and
steer it up. Shall we try one now with your heads in the picture?
So what, do you work here or something?
Matter of fact, I do. In charge of keeping the ice cubes cold.
Come, sit. Have some champagne.
Oh, thanks. That's sweet. But my friend and I are only here for the night. They say if you come here, sometimes you can see a celebrity.
Are you looking to buy some jelly? The stand's up the road.
No, we're looking for Margaret Sterling.
Hargrove. Margaret Hargrove.
I know who you're talking about. Marigold! She doesn't want any trouble. And we don't want any trouble.
Nor do we.
These two are looking for you. You know them?
When you're done with that, one of us should find some firewood.
When he's done with that, he's not going to be able to find his ass with both hands. I'll tell you what, Clay, why don't we switch jobs?
You want to get firewood, help yourself. There's no hierarchy, man.
Oh, believe me, there's always a hierarchy.
Do things by we think of something else. Everyone does what they want.
Good. Because I haven't felt this at one with nature since I was in the Navy.
Go ahead. Darn my grass.
Now I see why we're eating so early.
No. It's because we follow the cycles of the earth. It's gonna get dark.
Electricity and all that, it just brings problems.
But you've got a truck.
Yeah. That's been up for debate, man.
Does it get cold up here?
We light a campfire.
There's other ways to keep warm.
Come on.
Help me! Please!
Cooper James? I've been looking for you.
So, this rig tries to pass me, and I look over, and the guy in the passenger seat's wearing a ski mask, waving a rifle at me. Bastards cut me off. I hit the brakes as hard as I could.
How many other people in that rig?
Maybe four of them jumped out. All wearing masks. They opened fire. I thought they were gonna kill me. But then I'm getting pulled out, hands tied, blindfolded.
They mention any place, any location they might take these cattle?
No, they barely spoke. All I remember is getting tossed in the trailer with the cattle. They hooked it up to their rig, took off, then dumped me in the middle of nowhere. I just want to go home, see my wife and kids.
That's all we need tonight. Look, let's give Cooper a ride home.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks, Jane.
So, Shane, he never showed up to this live webcast?
No. We waited for him, but then we had to start. And then we find him. Little mom head full of all our money until we were old enough to get him thrown in jail. I'm glad it's you doing this. Get whoever did this. Okay, Jane? We're rehearsing to shoot a tribute to Shane. It'd mean so much to the fans.
You two made a pact to kill Shane. You shot him first, Ronan.
Take it. What? No.
And you fired into the ground because you couldn't bring yourself to shoot.
Oh, God, please.
But you had Ronan there to encourage you. Do it. But you never fired a gun before. So the slide cut your hand.
Oh, God.
Now put your damn hands behind your back.
You too. Come on.
So awesome, dude. I got to clap it up. I like the scene with the scenes with Angie Harmon. I mean, come on.
Yeah, my uncle still talks about that. He's like, so when you give it the hook, how was it? Yeah,
and you were in a scene with the guy from Animal House, dude.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So many. I mean, I've really been lucky. Like a lot of the people I've had the opportunity to work with are just amazing actors and all so supportive and really wonderful to work opposite of too. Like I've been really lucky. Yeah.
Well, we look forward to more things from you, Steve. Thank you so much for being
Steven.
Steve, that's right. I'm so sorry.
No, okay. We're getting back to present day. Our high school, like junior high reflection. Our little kid.
Yeah. You know what? Mario Moreno is listening. So, the Texas Sunrise.
Mario.
We're going to schedule together. But, dude, Steve, this was such a pleasure to interview you. And where can people find you if they want to cast you in their next movie, TV show, commercial? Give us the lowdown.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm fortunate to have my manager, Eileen O'Farrell Management, and that's where you can find me. It's all the links are on my IMDb page. You know, I've been doing a lot more voiceover work these days, so I'm down with that, like I said. But yeah, definitely check out my IMDb page that has links to find all my representation, management, etc. Or just give me a call. Talk to Nikki.
That's right. Dude, Steve, it's been such a pleasure. We're long overdue for a hang.
Yep.
Thank you once again for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. And on behalf of Sam, myself, and Steven, we'll see you guys next time. And tune in. We're going to have some more great stuff with Steve in the future. Regardless. Right, Steve?
That's right. It's just going to be memory lane all the way. Everyone's going to be riveted to their... Thank you, Steve.
You'll be me, dude.
Yeah. I'll do my best.
Love you, man. And
love
dude,
you too, bro.
Let's get that lunch. And shout out to Mario Moreno, Cantinflas,
and the Bros.
That's right. All right, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence. Right here on LA Talk Radio.